And you know, I'm going to take up on this, because I'm going to tell Smead of stuff, which I can read out, and it talks about how the series is, and the awards it's been, and the novels it's been, and the fellowships that she's gained, the Creative Writing Fellowship, the National Endowment,
here's Joel.
Here's Joel.
Her work being described as part of the provocative tragedy of his book. But I won't, because I would expect no less. But I would want to add, to this great big list, that in my experience of her since January, she is the most rare creature upon this planet, an absolutely human dynamo, and as we mix kindness and ideas like light, we must talk to her about it. Now, Melissa, I'm going to need more closer with you, but Melissa has been here now for 9 years. Now, Melissa Pritchard is Professor of English and Rural Studies at Arizona State University, and the author of 3 story collections and 3 novels. She too is awards, including the Flannery O'Connor Award and fellowships in the National Endowment of Arts. I do have a question, by the way, about Flannery O'Connor Award, which is, wasn't Flannery O'Connor the same guy that said, I often get asked if universities stifle writers. My view is that it doesn't stifle enough of them. Recent story collection, Disappearing Ingenue, was included on the National Public Radio's 2002 Annual Summer Reading List. And her newest novel, Late Bloomer, published in 2004 by Doubleday, is called Brilliant by Publishers Weekly and Ravishing by Vanity Fair Magazine. Deborah Futter, Vice President and Deputy Editorial Director of Doubleday, has said, Melissa is a true voice. She uses words in the most creative and fresh. I don't know any other writer who is so articulate with words. You can open a page of any other books and find 10 examples of that fluency. Her writing has tremendous heart. I think she is a real student of the human condition and can portray people deep down where they live emotionally while maintaining the human. And again, I would want to say that she's talked about it now for 9 weeks or so, and I know from observation of the student book, it's been an absolute inspiration. We're very honored to have you both. Now, Melissa will read first. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Melissa Pritchard and Jim Parker.
very much the throne daughters off the veil and compassion. Revelations of child love for the soul of Daniel. In 16 shooing, by bodily sight, by worthy sight. Revelation 1. Untenured professor, damp-winged peripheral, I bring Dame Nemo to the university, where she has trouble, difficulty getting on and off the tram, falls in the library, and I am shocked by her decline. I hold office hours, too, of them. In my anchorite's hoosegow, a negative enclosure, the voice from its walls, no visitors from me. Nemo wanders off to shop, in scarlet boy shorts, rump up flat, little red clay block, shoulders hunched under an expensive blouse, as if to say she requires more than the gold breastplate, which is her jewelry and defense. I will say this. Dame Nemo, though served unjustly, moves sturdily and well, stomps with politic vigor through the indifferent terrain of war. Revelation 2. A common butterfly, scooped from the pool this morning, drowned on blue netting, until I peeled up its silken flanges, black with yellow barring, its antenna, bulb at the tips like a bobby pin, set it flickering with content on an overturned brick by the clothesline. I have retrieved life, ignited a great deal. This occurred to me as through the dirty glass of the sliding door, I saw Dame Nemo in her saffron kimono, flecking about the cool, sparse enclosure of my rented house. But I fall. Revelation 3, in which the previous matter is restated. After her fall in the library, among books of criticism, I find Nemo dropped on a stone bench, wholesome youth brawling past, pale collegiates with polished limbs, vibrant voices, infallible strides. She bends, blots with Kleenex a stream of blood from the cut on her shin, loathing her old see-through skin, driving out his wings. I merely say, hold steady. You are becoming an invisible woman. But give her rather directions to town. Two blocks left, one right, you could do it, yes. Stand watchful as the blood-bright shorts, the turtle hunch, the hair, a thread halo. Wander off, dearest Nemo. Riffling through her purse, packing pockets, adjusting this, that, so busy, absorbed in her busyness, hawking at the solitary self, the irreparable instrument. What will she find? Revelation. Although it is October in Arizona, and the pool is icy as a mountain lake, Nemo steps forward, the dog prancing behind her on two rocked circus legs, in her black suit, nosegays of purple violets strewn around it, three flounces around the seat, a girly swim towel. Tugging on a white rubber cap, Nemo determinedly plunks in. Showing off, I plunge ambitiously black back and forth, scarcely breathing, and after her obsessive chatter of health and exercise, she must do what she does, which is to get in and plug away on her back, arms reeling, head slightly lifted, a plucky marshmallow. The dog, yipping convulsively at pool's edge, snaps at her white head as it goes by, dropping his blue rubber newspaper, the big growl, into the pool as she shoves by in. The dog adores Nemo. He complains the next day that her arm aches from hurtling the daily growl and Revelation 5. A Sears dryer, she offers. Oh, no, I demur. A new simple would be best. There's a clothesline in Arizona. It's all anyone needs. A white line to stiffen and bake the clothes, hanging the sheets and towels all caulked with Sonoran light. In a waiter's tone, a whisper. A whisper as if in a museum or perhaps a mortuary. In any case, the lighting is almost dull. There are no signs of life in the vacant living room. Family rooms, bedrooms, the silent dozens of rooms. Nemo hustles through the subdued labyrinth, while I slow to torpor by such a dollhouse maze, I finally spy the little figure, the beloved red block and white hunch, flitting spectrally through a colonial cherry bedroom. Nemo, I wail, frightened at having lost her in this mock. A sixth revelation, wherein Dame Nemo answers by way of spontaneous eulogy. Question. What would you miss if he were gone? Can't say he did. Nima has aversions to both word and subject, eliminating much fine literature and spirits from him. He's a great cuddler, I'll say that for Jack. And when we golf on Tuesdays and Thursdays, he says, "Show him, Tiger." Just when I swing, he's a tease. He calls me Butterball or Slim, and in bed says my nose drills a cold hole in his back. He's never beaten or abused me in any way. The father of Jones. Seventh Revelation, wherein a reminiscence occurs in yet another dim-lit place, a restaurant with a western theme, where we order identically pimping pumps and beef. I told you my childhood pizza was a dream. Johnny Bauer, first kiss. Paul Falsack, what's the name? First boyfriend. Margaret Fitzgerald married a poor dude. Hay rides and winter hot chocolate. Mother loved throwing parties. Used to go all out. Our Lady of Angels Elementary, then Mercy High, Cortez. Same street we lived on where you live. Imagine. What did I think about becoming a nurse? Always used to say I was going to visit my daddy in Davenport. No one knew what it meant. But I'd pack my cardboard suitcase and wait in a homemade gauze tent under a big river. She had more shoes than anything the granny would. Loved to garden. She stuck this big snowball bush by the back door and you had to fight past it to get outside. With her arthritis, she finally couldn't wear all those fancy shoes. Your great-grandma McGuire fixed me coffee with milk. Took me to see Mrs. Weeks of the Cabbage Patch. Grandpa slapped on the lilac vegetable at aftershave and puffed big rum-soaked cigars on the back porch. Aunt Mabel, oh, his sister, never cared much about her. Somebody claimed we came down from Wild Bill Hickok and don't know who. Write everything down for you. Bells, bells, I told you this time again. Special? No. That was not special. Mm-hmm. Revelation 8. Narrator's hasty confession. Hypochondria. Glorious infection. This week I have cancer. Three types. Breasts, cervix, ovaries. My sexual symptoms are evident. The last doctor I saw, a Dr. Ting, jaundiced and lean as a greyhound, I told this Dr. Ting as he fiddled with a light inside me, the body is a fuller, isn't it? All symmetry on the outside. The inside, a mess of planets and angles and shiftings, like textures and jargon. Mr. Rogers, the children's television friend, seems something like this. Boys are fancy on the outside, girls are fancy on the inside. What can he mean? Are we misled by the seemliness of our outside into expecting an equivalent symmetry in the universe? And why are we not permitted a peek at our interiors? This calls to mind the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, where I once saw in a little used hallway slices of humans, one man, one woman, both identified, both black. You could tell that you are the man. Sliced like a roll of lunch meat, or those tree circles entombed in plastic, presumably so visitors could glimpse someone else's interior, if not their own. These discs of human flesh were intricate. Should you allay suspicion over one ailment? Swiftly substitute another. For the body brilliant is host to infinite breakdown. The headache of high blood pressure translates into the rash of syphilis. The back pain of the kidney becomes the nether vein of obstructive colon, and so on. I devour medical texts in libraries, in bookstores. The stack beneath my bed is memorized. Nights pass busily for the hypochondria. Which is perhaps the point. What I am not permitted to see is most beautiful. Ninth Revelation. True. This is true. Mother keeps a baggie of big Newtons in her makeup kit. What a day does it, she giggles. She has given me a small, breezy bottle of Aura Glow from the Edgar Cayce Foundation. Yesterday I found her straddled on a bed following directions from a magazine article. Circling reduces abdominal fat. Abdominal fat. Mother jogs, bicycles, has practiced yoga, swims, and walks. She can wolf down 4 pieces of cake at one sitting. She's not consistent, which saddens me. 10th revelation. In which noise she makes leads to small conclusions. The first thing I experience when she arrives in my home is sound, flinging wide all the windows, chattering incessantly, then slip, slap, 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 slap down the hallways into every room like cannon artillery, short bursts of rubber bombs. I'm afraid to look at them all the time she's here. Their hard rubber birdshot noise frightens me. Revelation 11, comparison of modesty. The astonishing new thing about Mima is her savage immodesty. The first morning, I locate her in a crotch-high t-shirt in the backyard, posing for some reason the sidewalk, instead of watering the roses or the orange trees, tipped way over so her perfect chunky shorts show. Next, she hangs out clothes on the perfect white line, saying, "Lookie, I have the same bra," hoisting the t-shirt so I can view the identical bra. Lookie, upon 74-year-old nakedness. This glare of original flesh I was expelled from half a century ago stuns me. My body's consistently tricked. I've learned to conceive of its accumulation of scars, cysts, veins, wens, hairs, enshroud myself in prudish lengths of obscure materials. While she jaunts naked, she would say, as a chafer, a partial from Jaber, around my damask green citrus moon. I know a gentleman who must flip his mother-in-law's toenails Sunday evening, a disciple at her yellow clay feet. I know a woman who cannot leave her mother past 3 days. Her eyelashes grow into her eyes, and only this woman can trim the old mother's lashes. I'm terrified of Dame Nemo's mom, cavort and bone. Its macabre vigor, all the girth of the center, of pesky increase she variously slaps at, surface ritually, or sweet things, with all manner of candies, cakes, jellies, gifts. Revelation 12. A mighty desire to receive 3 thought wounds. The body as negative corral of grit. The body as theologic hospital, the family as pots or wounds slushing up all manner of stew, spontaneous corruption, pure invention. Revelation 13. Wounds received by way of memory in a matter of hours. I collapse and exhausted on the new sofa. I'm probably ill, certainly I'm ill. Mima's in the kitchen, noisy, half on one naked. Pots slam, cabinets open, and water runs in short, vehement bursts. When I awaken, the room is gone, and rich light comes from the kitchen, the rich, familiar smell of her cooking, of the food she's always cooked in the familiar way she's always cooked for. For the sweetest moment, dear husband, I'm in the home, full of food, little and careful. Nourished by a new mother working her family's tender acre to yield over time its fatal portion of risk. During my last wedding, she yapped like a parrot in the most sacred parts. She poked me in the eye while making the sign of the cross. At the reception, she refused to dance, ate piece after piece of almond wedding cake, looking absent-minded, yet stuffed with problems. This morning I slugged her in the arm, to stop her from jabbing everyone else, an irritating habit she's always had. "There," I said, "does that look like fun?" I couldn't look at Mima's face. It would have been awful to see what I had done, snapping. 14th revelation, the mother tongue. Flap doodle. Holy catastrophe! Holy volume! Ye gods! Scat before I knock you 6 ways to Sunday! Whoop de doo! Pete's sake! Hell's bells! Cripes! Holy Toledo! Oh, spit! 16th revelation, the fourth wound made manifest. There are cysts in the ovary that attain great size, grapefruits, cantaloupes, larger melons, nature's blunderings toward a child. When delivered surgically into Blair, they show themselves possessed of teeth, hair, bone, bits of ear. I feel under my bloated abdomen there exists one of these melons with teeth and hair, its eye turned inward and green. A 16th revelation wherein where minor catastrophe distracts from that most holy trial from which we can never be too. On the morning she is to leave, Mother and I take ourselves around the block, exercising ourselves in the dog, who carries his green leash in his mouth, trotting himself absurdly, forgetting my glasses and blind to everything, with a single pompous brass plume smoking up from what looks to be the roof of my rented house. Good God, the house is on fire! I shout to Nima, stumbling toward it and hearing her behind me. I didn't leave anything on. Several boys idle on the sidewalk, gawking. Boys, what's burning? One turns with no emotion. A car. Oh, yes, it's right. A Volkswagen bus, the same blue color as my house, is oddly in flames in front of my driveway. Mother and I are frightened to walk around it to get into the house. What if it explodes? We're very excited, standing like children in the street, as the fire engine arrives. Nima's dressed for her plane trip in what she calls her mother's superior suit. Dark navy, tailored and severe. More and more, her clothes resemble costumes to which she affixes names. Nurse Nancy, Mother Superior, etc. All part of the history and so on. The final image I have. She stands in the broad driveway, one wrist oddly flapped as if to mimic a homosexual stereotype, and chattering in a feverish, high-pitched voice to the fireman, none of whom is listening, busy, of course, with the fire. I called her. Mother Superior? Mommy, what are you talking to? Mom's listening. Before leaving the airport, I will purchase a plastic egg. Planted with cactus seeds. A transparent pencil loaded with desert pebbles. And a glassy tequila lollipop with a real tequila worm embedded in it. Trinkets I would have trumpeted for and wept to have as a child of memories. But before any of that, I will stand nose to nose with Nima's bright rudder face and watch it transfigure with adoration for her old child, so wildly and so devotedly trying to hold fast the gate against the wolves, who are, after all, part of the plan, both the natural and divine interests of conversion. Still, a little effect, where truth lies, a text memorized. At the birth market, what power, what determination in this tiny, frantic body! Life resides in this bit of nothing which animates a tuft of matter and which nonetheless emerges from matter itself and perishes with it. But the perplexity remains. Impossible to explain this fever, this perpetual dance, this representation of spectacle which life affords itself. What a theater. Where was you lying? Red shorts for courage. Age before beauty. Death before dishonor.
August 2nd, 1882, Cedar Hill, Uniontown, D.C. I used to I used to. Time once he told me I was the only free he needed. Time when he didn't want to get up from my arms. Time when I filled him, he filled me. The world loves Frederick Douglass, but I loved Frederick. I loved him when he had no name except a nigger this, nigger that. When he looked at me, he was broken. When he needed me, my flesh grew hot, and I opened myself, calling, Freddy. I thought the two of us would create a world. I'm dying now. Freddy died long ago. Was that a good thing? No more Freddy, just a great abolitionist. Was that a good thing? See Mr. Death sitting in the rocker telling me a come on. I will. Once I speak my mind like Freddy did. He told his tale, left me up. Begin at the beginning. Tell it true. Everybody knows Frederick's story. This one here, be mine. The narrative of the life of Anna Marie Douglas, a free woman of color, 1813 to 1882. I was born near Tux Creek in Carolina County, Maryland. My parents were freed a month before I was born. I'd be 8 of 12 children. Never was a slave. Never had to escape dogs or a bad master. But I seen my share of misery. It come rolling down, searing my back when I least expected. Freddy endured much. I appreciate that. I don't appreciate his feeling that hurt makes a person finer. He was forged, he said, forged like steel in the fire. I was forged by love. That's what tore me up. That's what I didn't expect. How can something that causes the sky to be bluer than blue, sends warm flooding your body, buckles your knees, and opens your soul to youth? How can what feels so good hurt till you want to scratch your skin off, snatch out the heart that feels so much? If love be true, you feel more than you felt possible, more everything, more glory, more pain than a touch. Frederick wanted me proper, like white women seem to be. But I wonder if they did, truly. I'm a woman and I feel everything. Even when I don't show it, I feel. Been feeling since the day I slipped out my man's body. Life was good with my parents. Always felt like a smile was growing inside me. A smile wider than a river, deeper than a well. My name, Deanna, but I was called Lil Bit. Wasn't but 4 pounds when I was born. Man had plenty of kids, but food was scarce. Ma'am didn't even know she was having me. Didn't know I was growing inside till almost the very end. She said her back ached, low and deep. Not to her body say push, did she think to lay down. No time to get the midwife. Just ma'am and me. Paul was in the fields. The other children were finishing chores. So ma'am laid down and I slipped out, she said. The easiest of all her children. Slipped out, swimming downstream with the birth water. Come dinner, ma'am told the family she had a surprise. Instead of cake, she brought out me. Everybody laughed when a bubble burst between my lips, glowing like a rainbow. Then Paul held me, called me Lil Bit, Lil Black Walnut. I was no bigger than that, and I was just that dog. Paul said I had sense to look like my man. All the other children were a blend of Paul's brown sugar and man's dark coffee. He said, Rudy and George and all the others turned out a fine color, sweet enough to drink. But he said, dark coffee be best. Dark coffee be what I married. One day, a good man be proud to marry you. I used to think Freddie'd be proud because dark coffee covered me. My mistake, he thirsted for everyone but me. Sweet cream, buttermilk, milk lace tea. I always thirsted for water, clear, cold, cup after cup. Man taught me water be a spirit, all things alive, she say, earth, wind, fire, water. The devil be afeared of water, afeared of water's ghosts. When they started carrying slaves from Africa, the devil be delighted. Good evil, he said. Plenty good evil. Water be furious. White men captured black men, women, and children. First water thought to smash their boats, but Mr. Wind wouldn't go along. Said water would smash innocents, too. What about their bones? The slave children's souls. So water swore that any slave that died inside it would find a new kingdom, not heaven, not hell, but a new world. Sometimes slaves died in storms. Most times slave catchers chained them, pushed them overboard. When slaves too sick, when pirates chased them, when the British come, captain shouted, dump, cargo. And all these women, babies and men crashed down, drowning in the sea. Lungs exploded, flesh eaten away. But their bones and souls still live at the sandy bottom. They say there be an army of 20 million. Skeletons, hard and strong, souls. They blend invisible with water. When Frederick travels by sea, I tell him, never fear. Bones be keeping him safe. He don't believe me. But 'tis true. And he, with all his trips to England, still lives. Frederick probably buried me in dirt, thinking me a useless black woman in the casket. I'd rather be buried in water. Won't go to heaven or hell. Don't care, water good or not. I was born, grew up around it. When I was six, I started making the summer living from it. Now, my novel, Douglas's Women, is an imaginative rendering of two women in Frederick Douglass's life. His wife, Anna Douglas, and his mistress of 28 years, Audley Essie. Now, while Douglas has justifiably been famous for over 150 years, Anna and Audley have languished, been obscured by a history that diminished their significance. What would it have felt like to have been the black wife and the white mistress of Frederick Douglass? Who was Anna? Who was Audley? Now, according to my research, Anna was a free woman of color, unafraid of hard work, and she loved in particular gardening. It also seems clear that without Anna's help, Frederick Douglass might not have escaped north. It was Anna who sewed him the seaman's uniform as camouflage. It was Anna who gave him the money. It was Anna who waited to see if he would send for her while she was surely pregnant before marriage. It is also true that Anna was 7 years older than Frederick and considerably darker. And while those details might not seem of particular interest to us today, in the 19th century with its color prejudice and its bias against mature women, such circumstances might have made Anna feel insecure. Without question, she married an extremely handsome, charismatic man. Without question, she married a man who was soon to become an icon. Now, Frederick often said that reading freed him, reading lit the corners of his mind. But Anna remained illiterate. In my world, her illiteracy is a part of her passive-aggressive behavior to remind Frederick that women's work matter. It was Anna who fed the children when Frederick traveled. It was Anna who nursed them through illness. It was Anna who rebuilt their house after the Klansmen burned it. Now, would the course of Anna and Frederick's marriage have been different if Anna had shared Frederick's love for books? Undoubtedly. But in my imagination, Anna says stubbornly, if I was good enough before I was married, why wasn't I good enough after? Now, who was Arlie? She was Douglas's mistress, and for a period of 14 years, Douglas would bring her to his summer home in Rochester. And he and Arlie would work, communion in the garden, while Anna was in the kitchen taking care of the kids. Because of her illiteracy, Anna tells her life story as an oral narrative. She's on her deathbed speaking to her daughter. Arlie relies on the 19th century women's tradition of letters, journals, diaries, etc. Paris, August 21, 1884. I didn't expect my life to end this way. Me, 58, sitting like a moonlight wrapped in furs, trying to stave off chills. The thought of America makes my heart cold. It didn't always. I am a snow queen. Love's betrayal has frozen my heart, sliver by sliver, except for one small piece. My heart is ice. Frederick Bailey Douglas, dearest Douglas, do I dare say you did this to me? Or was the blame mine all along? I, Utley Essen, so smart, not smart enough. I best hurry, scribble these words before time disappears, love disappears. Before I'm so cold, so solid, I cannot move except across the ocean from which there is no return, no renewal. No, gliding across the great Atlantic. No, recrossing the seas. Only stillness and death. Always, I wanted to sail to America, land of high purpose and dreams. Think of it, a bold experiment to have one's customs, one's culture begin anew, to be reborn, to carve from the landscape a new world. Not a nightmare world, but a realm of magical dreams. A land so vast and wide, anything can happen. A land not chained up, closed tight and small, like Germany. I hadn't counted on love's treachery. I'm dying in Paris, the city of life. Except there isn't any life. Frederick Douglass isn't here. Arlie was a surprise to me. I'd expected to write about Frederick's second wife, a young woman named Helen Pitts, but Arlie instead came into my novel and said, no, I am Frederick Douglass's wife of his mom. I am his spiritual and intellectual equal. Now, in Arlie's first crossing to America, she is 21, extremely idealistic, and she has an incident which changes her. I do not know what awakened me. I tremble as I write this, for it was indeed too terrible what I heard and what I saw. At first, I thought it was the wind howling, shrieking like a banshee of ghosts. There were sounds, too, of a weight being thrown or dropped in yawning silence. The noise, as much as the unnatural quiet, made me want to investigate. How I wish I had not. I threw on my wrap, not caring that my hair was unbound, and flung open the cabin's door. The wind was fierce, and for a moment I thought how it would knock me overboard. Calm seas had turned restless. My resolve lessened, and I thought to return to my cabin. The sounds were probably the wind lashing the sails. The wood strained under pressure, the ship creaking, shuddering at its rough progress. But a scream, a woman's scream, held me. There were women I knew, thin, pale women down below who were only allowed on deck between the hours of 8 and 10 and 4 and 6. In first class, there was only myself and Frau Müller. No honest woman would be out in the early morning with the moon still high, the wet spray singing and darkness shielding. The screams, more piteous, echoed again. I stepped gingerly, clutching the rail. Just around the bend, I saw Mr. Newcomb, no longer neat, elegant. windswept, his shirt wrinkled open at the neck, his pants hastily drawn over bare feet. He looked distraught, wild-eyed. I looked to where he was looking. One leg over the rail was a woman, stark, naked, so black she almost blended into the velvet night. Had she kept still, I might not have seen her, or else thought she was a mirage come out of the ocean's depths to haunt, or perhaps some forlorn spirit invisibly riding the Arctic wind. But the cold sent tremors through her body. Her entire body contracted to provide less surface for the wind's hips. And were that not enough, the silver chains about her wrists glinted almost like diamonds and proved that this was no apparition. How I wish that it wasn't so. Our eyes met, hers brimming luminous with tears, mine mirroring hers. You are my slave, Essie, Mr. Newcomb shouted. You'll do as I say. The black woman answered. Her words were formed, her meaning clear. No more. No more, she seemed to say. I will take no more. The captain, Herr Schmidt, the quarterdeck master, and rough sailors maneuvered forward, enclosing her, trapping her body against the sea. Let me help, I pleaded. Let me help. No place for a woman. Go back to your stateroom. Have you no sense? You've no right. I shouted back. No right. But the men paid no further attention to me. All eyes watched Hessie. Hessie tilted her head. Her eyes blinked, tears overflowed, and like someone dousing a candle, her eyes lost their light and were as dull as Mama's had been. She looked straight through me as though I, no, everyone on the deck were invisible. I placed my fist into my mouth to keep from screaming. Come on, Hessie. It's a misunderstanding. You needn't do anything you fear. I blushed. And even one of the sailors looked away. Were she not black, not a slave, not naked in the frigid air, one might have suspected that this was a lover's quarrel. Perhaps a virgin bride introduced to a boy quite bedewed. But Hessie was a slave, and she'd been chained. How long? We'd been at sea for a month, and I'd never, until this cursed night, seen her. How could it be that I didn't see her, or at least not hear her? Did I mistake her voice for wind howling, sea churning, spray lashing against wooden bows? How many sounds were heard that my ears, no, my mouth, mistook for a ship's crossing across the rough Atlantic? The sea has upset you. We'll soon be home in Virginia. Hessie looked down into the thunderous sea. We must be done with this, shouted the captain. A storm will have us overboard. Hessie, I breathe. She looked up, and I think she heard my soul crying out to her. Hessie, I said louder, my arm outstretched as though I could reach over and through the men's backs. Oh, Luan, I spoke back her name. You are mine, walked Mr. Newcomb, thumping his chest like some wild beast. Mine to do with as I will, grabber men ordered the captain, and they rushed forward, reaching, grabbing for her dark skin. Hessie, no, walk, without a sound, twisted beyond their grasp, a graceful, arcing movement, and let herself fall, no, die, into the choppy, velvet in the sea. Gone, without a whisper, without a trace, like a seal submerged, refusing to surface. Gone, as if she had been nothing more or less than a ghost. Everyone was silent, still, quiet, I thought, out of respect. Waves still lapped against the stern, sails whistled in the wind, and stars overhead blinked as if they were crying tears. $1,500 lost, Mr. Newcomb whispered. peering over the rail and into the sea. A dozen children she might have birthed. A fortune. A small fortune overboard. Banker Leader solemnly nodded. Herr Schmidt puffed his fat cheeks, and the captain patted Mr. Newcomb's back in sympathy. The sailors, some grinning at the excitement, some somberous priests went back to their posts. I was shocked. There was no rush to rescue. No man overboard for a slave, for a woman. I screamed, God shall punish you. God punish you. Mr. Newcomb, the captain, Herr Schmidt stared at me. They thought me crazy. A witless woman. Not witless enough. I will carry the older one's pain to my grave.
Thank you, Bert.
Yeah, cool.
But I said, every point in the discussion about the partnership between Warwick and Arizona, I've always felt that we as writers, we as students, and we as colleagues could learn more from you than you could probably learn from us. And the question I want to really frame is, I've sat in the Arts Centre conference room now for 8 years, watching fiction writers, poets, scientists read out their work. And I have to say that the way in which both you, Melissa, and you, Jewel, but also Ron and Jay read their work rather than performed their work puts the vast majority of the people who have been through this room to shame. Now, I've always had this argument that poets are hungrier, they have to work harder than novelists, and therefore they have to kind of sing for their supper. And very often it's the case that it's the poets who kind of perform their work more honestly, get the precision of their language across more clearly, communicate more effectively. And, you know, they sell more books as a result. Whereas we've had novelists come here, novelists of great note. I exclude all the South Americans from this comment, by the way, and include most of the British, who basically mumble their way through the text. They're known for the Guardian, the Times, the London Review of Books. They're kind of leaning very heavily upon a reputation that's bought the audience because they've seen them on TV, heard them on the radio, to a performance, which they've then just lumbered their way through, and then the people have come up and they've bought the books. And there's part of me that's fine about that. It's a commercial enterprise, and there's part of me that's ashamed. Now, what is it about the genetic code or the learning of the teaching of four American authors from Arizona that you can wipe the floor with all these people? And I know that you, Melissa, had a background in acting. I know that you were once a poet. I don't think these things are particularly pertinent. What is it? What is it that we do so, that you do so well, that we don't do so well? Because your readings were, all four were completely honest, very clear. They weren't performances, per se. How do you do that? What can we learn from you? What can I learn from you?
You first.
Oh, me first. I have a ready answer for that. No, I don't. Well, I can't speak for Jewel, and I can't speak for Jay and Ron, although I've heard all of them read, and they're all... I'll speak for Ron. And then Jay, and then Jewel, and then everyone else, yeah. I don't know. I do have a background in theater. I'm a frustrated actress. I wanted to be an actress. I trained to be an actress. I had grand dreams of being an actress. And then I gave it up one day when I read the statistics of success in theater. And they were very, very grim. And I thought, well, I can't sing or dance, as far as I know. And I can only act. And supposedly you had to be able to do everything across the board. So I gave it up. And I didn't know I could write. I'd been told I had some small talent at writing. So I thought, well, I'll just crawl into my basement apartment and write. At least I have my own material, you know. And so I think when I read, I mean, I can only speak for myself, when I read, It's stepping into that same space as acting, and I'm not me. I'm very shy, and I'm very almost have panic attacks. But I don't when I read because it's not me. It's my character, right? It's the voices in the story. So that I do, and it's projection. You learn things like projection and stuff. That's all I know about that. And I know Jewel has a background in theater. That's a terribly dull answer, but that's all I can
I suppose what I want to ask you is, if you had a curriculum of creative writing, undergraduate or postgraduate, or in the community, would you place as much emphasis upon I'm not happy with the performance word here, but it is the word, with the performance, the delivery of that to public by speech, teach them that?
If I can just say this, I do try to tell my students, you know, I'd actually love it if we had a course, and Jewel and I have talked about this, and so far it hasn't happened, but I think it will, where I've wanted to have my students actually take theater courses in acting. It's wonderful because you're on stage and you work with props and you work with characterization, many of the same things, but it's translated into physical space and physical action. And you can take that into your writing and you learn how to project your voice and these things. And I've often thought that would be really valuable for our students to do that. And also many of them do get nervous giving readings, and to get over that, I think it would be good just to have a course in which we do that kind of training. I think it is valuable because that's part of the narrative, is the spoken narrative and the emotion that comes through. Don't you think?
Absolutely.
I'm turning this over to you. Don't you think? Speak.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
For myself, I can't write anything not unless I hear the voice.
Right.
And I oftentimes describe what I do as dramatic fiction writing, because where I would like to act on a stage, but I don't anymore. When I'm writing, I visualize a proscenium stage, and I play all the parts, and I'm all the characters. So that's why sometimes when I'm writing, I'll be crying, or if it's a sex scene, I'll be hot and bothered, or, you know, that live these lives, you know. And so for me, though, I can't write not unless I hear the voices. And Michael's early question about the first sentences, I pretty much know all my first sentences. So whether it's a young man in the 1920s or a voodoo queen, because until I can get that first sentence, I can't write it. Or if you've noticed, particularly in the first part of this book, I know it by heart. And in fact, when I'm writing, I have to go back to the beginning, and I literally have to say it to hear it. And if I don't hear it, then I can't somehow connect emotionally to it. And once I connect emotionally, that's where the passion comes from. So it's not in some sense passion as performance, but it really is truly passion as writing. So that you can come to my novels that are all very different, and you may like this or not like that, but most people tend to agree that all of my books, certainly you can feel the emotional investment in them, that the characters finally sometimes stand up and live and make their presence really known.
I'd say that's the truth for me, too. I always read my work aloud to myself, and it has to be, there's a musical quality I'm looking for, and an emotional quality I'm looking for, an emotional honesty. And each piece has a different piece. It's a different music. It's a different score, absolutely. And I've written, like Jewel, all sorts of historical decades, modes, contemporary comedy, tragedy, everything. And I learned that in theater, that you could be anybody. You could be hundreds of characters. You're not just limited to one, two, or three. And so I'll go into, you know, 1920s Luther Burbank, the horticulturalist, and his relationship with Paramahansa Yogananda. I mean, and there I was, you know.
Absolutely.
Or I can be. So it's a wonderful liberty to go anywhere and be any voice. And you're trained in theater to do that.
I think
that's probably the most valuable thing I learned.
It is liberating. And one of the things that I sometimes get frustrated with, though you are, in a sense, always writing about what you don't know, you know, that I'd like to see more daring. So if I want to write about, you know, the decline of the Japanese samurai class, sure, I can do it. So that if I want to write about whatever, I can do it. If I want to do the voodoo queen in the 19th century, I can do it. Because what you trust is the power of your own imagination. And you trust the power to be able to tell those stories. And in fact, I though I've just finished a contemporary, I find it difficult to write contemporary because I very much write for lives that I haven't yet lived that I want to. And I, in fact, think that my life gets bigger and my heart gets bigger. So I don't. So I find out what I knew about these things, but I start from what I don't know. See, Frankie said yes.
I don't want to come across all kind of Jeremy Paxman about this. Jeremy Paxman is a cultural reference that I'm pretty sure that I will understand. But do you? Would it be an awful contention to say that many contemporary novelists have 10 ears?
10 ears?
I mean, one of the things that
I think they have 10 plots sometimes.
10 plots.
10 plots. And I don't know.
Is the ear for language and for the precision of language and for the music of it?
I don't know. You can't put us on the spot like that. What I get frustrated with is with the scale. That especially if you're in your school, why are you doing something that's in your comfort range? You know, that's very narrow, very here. And so it's like, I like people when they're daring and ambitious and they're wrestling the chaos. I mean, that's part of the power, so that you can do a novel now, and of course 20 years from now you can do it better, but it's really the wrestling with the chaos, not writing out a comfort zone. And sometimes it feels to me that a lot of writers are writing out the same comfort zone, and in fact American publishing encourages you to do that. I have all kinds of great stories about how I always got in trouble. Nobody would want books because it wasn't like the last book.
Right.
You know? Yes. And it's like, well, if you would just keep writing what you wrote before, it would be fine.
Yeah. This happens in Britain.
Does it happen in Britain too? Well. Yes. Yeah.
Just to up the scale again then. Do you think it's one of the biggest lies of creative writing teaching that our purpose is to help people find a voice rather than actually finding the thousands of voices that are
artists. I think you have thousands of voices and thousands of styles. And don't you also think, and then I'll be hush, like what Melissa was saying, when you have a novel, I mean, there's a novel like where it's going to be languid and imagistic, right? And then there's going to be another novel. Hey, here's the train. It's leaving the station. Go down the track. And part of the fun is adapting your style to what the subject matter requires, what the characters require, not that you have one style that you write from.
I don't know. That's exactly, we're quite...
See?
Yeah. The story I read tonight, and I read it because it was short and because it was based on Dame Julian of Norwich, and here I was in England, you know, so I thought it would be appropriate. But that was strange because that came out of I was very irritated with my mother when I wrote it. She lived with me for 2 weeks right after I got married, and there she was. My husband wasn't there, but she was there, and I was going nuts. And I'm sort of obsessed with my mother. I have a great love for her, which is quite interesting. And so I thought, after she left, I thought, I have to write. I'm going to go mad. I have to go to therapy, or I'll have to write something, because I can't afford therapy, so I'll write something. So I wrote this story, and in the writing of it, which I thought was kind of a just releasing of some irritation and love, but I realized it was... when you go deeper into your voice and deeper into the emotional honesty of what you're writing, and you peel off these layers and you get really truthful with yourself, what I was confronting was I was mourning the eventual death of my mother. I loved her so much. There's a tremendous grief in that story, and the body and the temporality of the body. And it was a much deeper this story than I'd ever imagined. And if I'd known that starting out, I wouldn't have had the nerve to write it. I probably would have thought, oh, I'm not up for that. You know, that's pretty... But I just went and thinking, I have this energy. I have to kind of get on the paper. So I think that in the creative writing classes, to answer your question, I think Jinjul does this too. We all do. We try to encourage the students to not narrow, limit, or predict to themselves too closely, too carefully, to have that emotional courage, to range out further beyond comfort zone. I'm big on language. I'm big on memorizing poetry and reciting it in class. And 10 words a week, as dumb as that might sound, I want you to put 10 words a week in a journal and learn them and use them. And I've got my students here. They're wonderful. They're trading words every week, and they're doing all sorts of things. And I see them show up in their stories. And, you know, to expand your palette of language beyond the normal, whatever small amount of words we normally use in conversation. So I, like you, I urge, you know, oceanic, you know, kind of grasp of story, language, beyond the grasp which is easy for you. Because all these selves do inhabit you, are there to be tapped and listened to. and then connected with emotional truth. Passion.
Cool. Next voice, then.
What? Oh.
Questions. Oh, sorry, I couldn't see you because of the light.
Okay.
Yeah? Could you turn the lights up, please?
Right. Yeah, I have this immense, I don't know where I got it, but I have this immense reverence for words. I think they're a form of magic, and I mean magic in the traditional sense of magic. And I think that when you begin to look at root etymologies of words and you begin to open up and crack open the clues of each word, you're just blown away by them. You know, where they, if you trace them back to sources and origins, and you see that they are these living essences that you're working with. They're alive. The language is alive. And so I approach each word almost, I admire poets tremendously. I have a frustrated actress, a frustrated poet, a frustrated painter. I'm frustrated at everything. So I write. But I write fiction. But I really think words are I handle them with great care, and I realize how one appears next to beside the other one, and it can change if there's another word on the other side of it. I mean, it's so subtle, the energies of words and the power of words. And then if you've worked as Victoria has and Jewel has and other people in theater or in the spoken word as well as the written word, you come even closer to that idea of magic, that idea of power in language. Even your name has power, and it has a meaning to it, and a power when it's invoked. That's why sometimes it's important people change names or call themselves something differently or are named in a way that's shaming to them or humiliating. It's so powerful. Words are so powerful. Look in the daily papers and how strongly people react to names and the way things are named, the way we create... Well, about politics now, wars, myth of fear. I'll stop. Okay, no. I'm done. Power, the language is extraordinarily powerful. Feel that way about you. I feel completely intimidated here. I think everyone's much smarter than I am, much better. They speak so beautifully. I'm like, oh, I must catch up. So I'm up late every night reading.
Just a friend. That's how we colonize the planet. Helen.
It's true.
Picked on you again, huh? Yes. I'm not sure necessarily that you need to continue a dialogue, but I think that it happens an awful lot. And also in African American tradition, we're always talking back to our narrative. So, talking back in the oral history, the call and response, So in particular, when I pick up my details from African American history, I am opening up this dialogue and sometimes having both of them, you know, the weight of them go back and forth, as well as trying to make a dialogue go back and forth between my text and the audience. I think a lot of the things that I do end up being much more, Ron used the word marginal, but I'm always in, to write about a voodoo queen and the legacy of, you know, zombies in America, I've taken a lot of grief for that. So in some sense, there is this dialogue of women's text, African-American text, and in particular, what I like to dialogue about are the things that I'm not supposed to be, that we're not supposed to be talking about. And I've either sometimes been told you shouldn't be talking about that because you're a woman, or you shouldn't be talking about that because you're black, or you shouldn't be talking about that because you're from the West. And so that sense of silencing, I'm always working against. I've never written a single book that I haven't had some form of significant backlash about because I was talking about what I wasn't supposed to. So I actually think that that's the role in terms of extending the dialogue that we're doing, talking about. In this picture, there's a picture of a white woman and a black man. This is a jacket cover of the novel, and they completely left out the black woman. This particular book, it was turned down by 23 publishers because, one, no one would want to read a black woman with black dialect. And you can see for yourself that the dialect's not that heavy. So finally, we took the offer from Simon & Schuster, which my agent advised against because it was so low, more than one of my first novelist students was getting. And she says, oh, you shouldn't take that. It'll ruin your career. And I laughed because I said, oh, I'm still getting paid to write what I would write anyway, so fine. As soon as they bought it, the black editor who bought it told me I had to get rid of that white woman. And then I said, well, I'm not going to. Then we published the book. And then after that, I get a lot of crap for how I'm destroying African-American culture and don't we need role models like Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass was just a man. You know, he wasn't perfect. So I always, what is it, transgressive. I always keep saying what I'm not supposed to say according to some group or another. Oh, good.
Me too.
We have more in common.
We do. We never talk like this.
We
pass each other in the hall. writing our transgressive things, I guess. Yeah, this latest novel of mine is set in contemporary Arizona, and it has a lot to do with Native American culture, contemporary Native American culture, which I'm quite familiar with and have come to know quite well in a contemporary sense, not the stereotypical sense of Native Americans that most people know and reference. And it was a risk writing that. It was a terrific risk, both from being criticized from the Native American side, which actually I haven't gotten, but from, you know, what are you writing? Who are you to know these things? And it felt very dangerous to write that novel. And I actually go where the danger is. I'm like attracted to it. And I thought, but this is the truth. This is the truth that I know and have seen and experienced. And I know it's, you know, and I want, and it needs to be told because I run into these stereotypes all the time. And then in terms of the story I read tonight, the Dame Julian and Norick, that, a lot of times I'll write, it's all serendipitous, it's intuitive, I work a lot from intuition, and a student had given me as a gift The Revelations of Divine Love by Dame Julian of Norwich. She knew of my interest in mystical texts and thought I would be interested, and actually I thought it was sort of dull, but I loved the way it was, yeah, I did, but some religious writing is a little bit dull, and but I love the form of it. The 16 revelations in shoeings. It was that old, you know, I thought it just enraptured me. So then I had, sometimes you have an emotionally congested piece, an emotionally charged, brimming piece, and it's chaotic almost, on the verge of chaos, because of so much emotion and imagery. How to control, how to give it a shape. And it just, boom, I thought, that's it. You know, I put it together. And it wasn't any kind of woman thing or it was nothing. It just came together. And it happens in my work a lot, that I'll just, sometimes in church, I'll be in mass or something, and I'll get an idea for, what story was that? It was another story. But all of a sudden, and I've been pondering it. I knew the story. I had started to write it. I couldn't find the shape or the form, what I call the form for it, the way it's going to manifest.
I'm sitting there in mask and I'm distracted, and all of a sudden I go, oh, that's it. And I shaped it after something that was in a book of commentary or something. I don't know. I went home and I was like, that's it. You know, because, but it has to be part of the ecology of the piece. It has to be part of the organic nature of the piece. And a lot of it's intuitive. You just know. You just know that fits. It works. Just the vessel is it's the right shape for the piece.
And in my case, particularly for Douglas's Women, the sort of the narrative shape was a slave narrative. There's a very particular form for how a slave narrative is created. And within the African-American literary tradition, the slave narrative is really the very first piece of literature that was indigenous to us as a people. And it begins with this ritual of I was born, moving through childhood, moving to this moment of where you attain a kind of freedom that's spiritual before it's actually literal, you know, or physical. And Douglas has reaches that in his famous narrative. But then women's narratives, black women's narratives, are almost entirely missing, you know, and that they deal with those issues of sex that was, you know, more than the 19th centuries could take, that it couldn't be manipulated by a kind of the abolitionist cause in the same way that they could take this man who says, I am literally scribing, writing myself into being. So then to take these two women that history have forgotten, they begin that same ritual of scribing themselves into being, one orally, because she's illiterate, the other one through writing. And interestingly enough, Ottilie actually commits suicide in that Paris hotel because Frederick has married the younger white woman. And she finds out about it by reading the Paris newspapers. But she dies, and before she dies, she makes sure that her will leaves all her money to Douglas. And Anna does her thing. But so in that sense, there were things that I was talking back to in terms of a narrative structure that helped me rein in the chaos rather than the process Melissa was just talking about where she uncovered it as she was going along. So it can happen all kinds of different ways, and each project will be different. Yeah. That you'll know that structure and the skeleton that hang things on and other things, it's completely, it comes to you maybe after 6 or 7 months worth of working, yeah. That or it just comes organically out of your stomach.
There's an eviscerating magic to the word end. There's a taxi waiting for the poor writers to whistle away to give them some food. Because fiction writers don't have the scene for themselves, at least beforehand. So I'm going to have to bring to a close, I'm sorry. Could I just ask you, thank you very much, Jewel. Thank you very much, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.